Moncrief on News Talk.
While Donald Trump's two most recent military targets have been Venezuela and Iran, he's not exactly keen on Cuba either. And that recent action against Venezuela has had a direct effect on that island, cutting off its already scarce supplies of oil. So how are people doing there? And can the regime survive? The journalist Hannah McCarthy is just back from Cuba. Hannah, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Is there a difference between what it's like in the capital and around Cuba in general?
So resources have always been focused on Havana, the capital. You know, any tourists who've been to Cuba will kind of have been to Plaza Vieja and have seen kind of the very nice facade of the reconstructed area of Havana. But if you go even to other areas of Havana, you'll have much poorer electricity supply. And there is, there's Cubans that will say, for much of the past few years, particularly since the pandemic started, they've had rolling blackouts. So that's not new for them.
Mm, yeah. And have they got worse since the Venezuela situation?
It has definitely gotten worse. So people said they had gotten used to some blackouts, but I think the way it was impacting transport was new. The way that buses were being taken off the roads, people could not reliably get home from work. That's when I started to notice people getting very panicked. They were waiting in the main squares for taxis to take them home, and they were just crowding around any taxi coming back at 9 p.m. clearly quite panicked about whether they'd be able to get home. We're hearing reports of the current blackout that it just happened randomly. There are people who were out, there was 200 people queuing for buses in some parts, and they just had to try and find their way home in this blackout that is the most recent one. So it's just sowing an element of chaos. There are people who've got some dollars, got generators, that have some reserves, those people who have, relatives abroad. But anyone who's vulnerable, older Cubans, they're in a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah. And those blackouts, are they given warning? Are they regularized to any degree, or could they happen at any time?
I think if you're in rural parts of Cuba, the default is that you don't have electricity. So that's your default. In Havana, there was definitely an effort to keep the lights on in the areas that tourists might be in old Havana, but there wasn't a kind of regularized pattern that I've seen in other countries where I know to expect that there will be a blackout, 3 to 5 or so forth.
Yeah. Now, the health service in Cuba was always seen as something to be admired. Even doctors and nurses were an export to a degree. Is that in a poor state now as well?
I was really taken aback by the story that people were telling me there. Cubans were telling me, they were describing how, if you are a Cuban suffering from cancer, you have to go to the hospital 3 days before your treatment, ask them, do you have everything I need? If you don't, you then have to go to factories in Cuba to try and get your medication. There are people whose relatives in Cuba or in Miami are spending thousands of dollars buying medication in Florida and getting it flown over. Very, very worrying stories about women giving birth in hospitals, having to get taxis after arriving to the hospital they've been getting, care from during their pregnancy, and having to go to another hospital. And then, overhearing other women being told, unless they can pay, they won't be getting a cesarean that they've been told they need by their other doctor.
My word. Are there any tourists there now?
There were still some tourists when I was there. I think there's some people, my sense is there's some people who have been going to Cuba for years, and they feel like they know it, they know their way around, they're comfortable with the blackouts. And again, if you are a tourist facing industry, you have dollars and you probably have a generator and you're probably equipped to deal with, a crisis for a couple of weeks. But I mean, there's real issues with just, you can't insulate yourself from a total blackout. There's only so far you can go, in the sense it's not fun to just hang around your building if you can't venture onto the street because of how dark it is. I think that's really, impacting people's, ability to move around or feel safe. People were warning me in a way that they said, they hadn't had to do before, just about walking around at night. They said there's definitely a declining sense of security. There's less policemen on the streets. Maybe they can't have fuel to actually do the tours, or they're not kind of able to turn up for work in the same numbers. So there is a slight, people are definitely less easy at walking around at night in a way they said that is quite new.
Yeah. So pretty much all public services are suffering then. What about the education system?
So the education system already had a lot of issues. So I spoke with one kind of teacher who said that there for years before there had already been issues with lack of resources, lack of books. If you are young and ambitious or have any skills, you are leaving the island. So that there was huge shortages in terms of teachers. But at the same time, you still had to send your children to school. It was not acceptable to keep them home, even if you knew they weren't going to be taught. Mm. You'd be reported on. And what's happening more recently is that the schools are, you know, in theory shifting online, but there's obviously very few resources for children to access classrooms online. But, you know, they cannot get buses to schools. If you're in a rural area, some of the schools in Havana were still operating because most pupils could walk. But I mean, parents are very anxious about this. You know, I think Cubans took a lot of pride in education. They talked about, you know, the education being great in the 90s and the 2000s. They're really concerned about, you know, the gap in education for their children. And it's pushing a lot of them to emigrate because they just do not see a future for their children, particularly in that education system at the moment.
Can they emigrate?
So, I mean, they have over the last 5 years. I mean, the estimates range from about 1 million to 2 million who have gone through kind of legal and illegal routes. You know, there is sympathy in Latin America for Cubans. They're, you know, they speak the same language. They're, you know, culturally close. There had been avenues that were open to them. There has always been ties with America. There used to be a very helpful program for Cubans who were claiming asylum in America. It was very easy for them until this Trump administration. So what you have is that pressure valve of kind of, you know, emigration of, you know, young, kind of maybe more ambitious Cubans who are going to kind of forge a life for themselves. I mean, they're not able to leave in the way they used to. Even countries that like Nicaragua are not providing the avenue out of Cuba that they once did before. So again, it's all about turning up the heat. You have, you know, a worsening humanitarian crisis and very few ways out for these Cubans.
Yeah. They actually, just going back to the tourism aspect, if there's a shortage of oil, I assume there's a shortage of aviation fuel as well. Is that curtailing flights into the island?
Exactly. The day after I arrived, Havana Airport announced that they would not be able to provide aviation fuel for any flights that were arriving that required kind of a refuel option. So this obviously immediately cut airlines that were operating long haul flights to Havana who needed that option, because it would be too costly for them to, you know, stop over at another location, the Caribbean or Mexico. So instantly you had Canadian airlines cutting flights. That's a huge source of tourists for Cuba. Air France has stopped. I would expect Mexican airlines that can operate on a short-term basis will keep going. But again, it's just cut off instantly a very much needed source of currency that kind of ripples through the Havana economy. You know, they're not buying their coffees. They're not going on. They're not using taxis. They're not using the vintage cars. Mm. So, I mean, it just sends a kind of, you know, it cuts off so many, you know, different jobs in the economy.
Yeah. To a degree, I suppose Cubans are well used to this kind of living in perpetual crisis, though this seems, again, even worse. Who are they blaming for it?
So again, the Cubans I spoke with, they seem to be more blaming their government. There was, again, I noticed among the older Cubans, they were quicker to talk about the blockade from the US. So the US always describes the sanctions regimes that it has imposed on Cuba as an embargo, i.e. a bilateral restriction on trade between the US and Cuba. How that actually operates, you know, more recently with a globalized financial system and an interconnected supply chain system, is that it's very hard for Cuba to import from many different countries. Mm. If something, a product has 10% US parts, it can't be imported. It needs an export license from the US. If I was sending a bank payment to someone in the US and in the description I said Cuba, it's liable to be stopped. So Cubans are always very keen to call that a blockade in terms of the commercial restrictions. And now, again, what we're seeing since January is an oil blockade in a very traditional sense of what that means. There are US vessels in the Caribbean that will stop oil tankers and vessels and seize them if they believe they are going to Cuba. So again, you know, that among the older Cubans, there's, I guess, there is still that kind of sense of, you know, us against America. But younger Cubans, I mean, they were not motivated. I was not getting a sense that they are like, you know, we've got to keep fighting against the US. I mean, they want to change. They want to see an improvement in their daily lives. And I think their anger was more focused on the government.
Yeah. Though, that, is it unlikely that will express itself in any meaningful form in the sense? It was only a few years ago there were protests and, you know, the government reacted in the way the government there always reacts to dissent.
So yeah, there was even there was a very small protest in central Havana, I think 2 weekends ago. And again, even though there aren't police in force at night, they were there very quickly to take people away to jails. There are still Cubans in jail who protested in 2021, basically against the rising cost of living in Cuba. And they are still in jail, some of them. So for Cubans, they are struggling to get water, food, get by with very little electricity and fuel every day. Many of them feel like my family does not have the time or bandwidth for me to go to jail. And it's a one-party system in Cuba, so there's no political opposition that's organized. That's kind of rallying focal point. The main kind of, I guess, opposition is, you know, in Miami. And again, there is a bit of a divide there between Cubans. I mean, obviously, lots of them have like familial ties. But Cubans in Cuba are somewhat suspicious of some of the Cuban Americans about, you know, their approach and about, you know, how, and again, the Cuban Americans in Miami have largely defined themselves as anti-Castro and have kind of taken quite hardline approaches and are again a big kind of Trump supporter base. So there's tensions in how that works as an opposition if there's suspicion between both Cuban Americans and some of the anti-government kind of those who would have kind of anti-government views in Cuba.
Yeah, so there's no clear way out of this really at the moment. And in terms of the Cuban leadership, Raúl, Fidel's brother, retired a few years ago. So, like, is he behind the scenes still a power?
So 94-year-old Raúl is still viewed as someone who, you know, acts as something of a power broker in the sense that anyone who at the age of 94 can act as a power broker. And the Castro family, you know, occupies again a kind of powerful role behind the scenes. And there was some discussion about whether maybe Raúl Castro's son might be a kind of interlocutor with the US. And actually, what we're hearing is that there are kind of reports behind the scenes that there has been some outreach between the US administration and Raúl Castro's grandson, which is interesting because, again, it's sending a message that there's possibly an idea that there would be a transition that would keep some of the Castro government intact, not do some short, sharp kind of regime overhaul that might create, you know, a refugee crisis that suddenly has people leaving en masse by boats to Jamaica, the Bahamas, Florida. At the same time, I mean, you know, Trump's foreign policy is kind of net. I mean, it's very hard to predict. You know, we started, like, there was a lot of discussion about Trump being someone who was anti-war, doesn't like, you know, big military operations. That's still what people were talking, using. That's a descriptor people were using to describe him in relation to Cuba earlier this year. I think with the war in Iran, again, it creates a lot of uncertainty about how far he will go and what is the approach. So far, it seems like they're not interested in boots on the ground in Cuba or military invention.
Yeah.
At the same time, lots of question marks, as always, with Trump.
Yeah. Well, there is at one end of Cuba anyway, some number of American military who could perhaps do something to people in Cuba think it's inevitably this current regime will inevitably crumble away.
I think everyone felt there has to be a change. Something has to give. They cannot keep going like this. I think the fact that there was this kind of liberalization of relations under the second Obama term, I think has given Cubans a bit of an appetite for improved relations with the US. I think the fact that only a few years ago they remember the good times, they remember earning, you know, a couple of $100 a day. I was talking to a Cadillac driver, a vintage car driver in Havana, and he was like, yeah, we were still getting some of the Europeans, but, you know, Europeans like the same things as the Americans. They just don't pay as much.
Yeah.
You know, even people who might have grown up under Castro still like nice American tips.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, I just think people kind of feel that it's almost in reaching distance to have that kind of, I guess, economic kind of security or future back again. And I think that quick cycle of boom to what feels like bust to them.
Yeah. Must be extraordinary. Hannah, thanks a million for coming in to tell us about that today. That was the journalist Hannah McCarthy there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.